I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. Yanis Varoufakis did the impossible last summer, and he's still doing it this hour. If you can believe it, he's breathing high drama, an aura of history, human principle, and high purpose into the story of a bad debt. As finance minister of Greece's radical left government in 2015, Varoufakis got famous first for his flair, the guy with the open shirt and shaved head on a motorcycle, but then really famous for the supreme folly of saying no to Europe's central bankers. His line was that Greece could not, should not be forced, as a price of staying in the European Union, to take on huge new loans to pay off bad old ones. Fiscal waterboarding, he called it. A bailout of the banks. No benefit to Greece, he said. Greek people loved him, but his prime minister abandoned him in the crunch. Varoufakis lost his battle and his job and went back to teaching economics at the University of Athens. But the third phase of his fame had just begun. As the loser who told the truth about the brutal logic of finance for finance's sake. He's at it again this summer, in book form, his title drawn from the inhuman code of Athens's ancient warfare with Sparta. Their line was, the strong do what they want, today meaning the banks and the rich, and the weak suffer what they must. Varoufakis adds on the cover of his book a question mark, as if to say, really? The fight for Europe, and England's Brexit vote against union is part of it, he says, is between the spirit of democracy and the power of wealth. In conversation the other day, I asked him to speak about the direction of things in Europe 2.0, post-Brexit.
Well, Europe itself is at stake. Brexit has unleashed, as I was expecting, very powerful forces of disintegration, both on the left of the political spectrum and on the right. Just to give you an overview of what I think the main game is now, outside of Britain, everybody can read and listen to the developments from the British front. All three major parties have collapsed in a sense. Their leaderships have gone to ground, they're changing leaders. But the main impact of Brexit is not so much on Britain, it's going to be on Europe. Mm. And here we have, just to sum it up for you, in my estimation at least, we have a three-party tussle. On the one hand, you have the president of France, François Hollande, who is beleaguered, who is facing a presidential election next year, which he will certainly lose. He may even be humiliated by not making it to the second round. And he's trying to milk the fear that Brexit has caused in order to pull out of the proverbial hat a rabbit that may save his career, may save his presidency. And that rabbit, from his perspective, is some kind of concession from Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, that the monetary union, which we created some decades ago and which is teetering on the verge of collapse, will be accompanied very quickly by some kind of economic and political union. That's what Hollande would like to be able to say to the French people prior to the 2017 presidential election, that I, François Hollande, managed to convince Angela Merkel to yield on economic and political union. Hmm. Angela Merkel, on the other hand, as she always does, this is her normal game, is playing for time. She is a politician that will never make a decision today if she can postpone it until tomorrow. She intends to stall on political and economic union with France, primarily with France, as much as she can. And then there is a dark horse, somebody I've known personally, Dr. Wolfgang Schäuble, the finance minister of the Federal Republic of Germany, who is the only man with a plan in Europe. There's no one else that I've met or that I know of who actually has a plan for Europe. Unfortunately for Europe, it's a pretty dire plan. It's a pretty awful plan. But nevertheless, it's a plan. And his plan is to use Brexit. In my view, he actually contributed to Brexit. I think he wanted Brexit. I think the way he spoke down to the British public, it was like an incitement for them to vote for Brexit. He wants these crises. He wanted Grexit. He wanted Greece to get out of the Eurozone last year. He told me so explicitly himself. He wants Brexit in order to put the fear of God into the French so as to make them accept as a price for a very limited form of economic and political union, direct German control over the French national budget. So these are the battle lines, the way they've been drawn. And I'm very much afraid that it's not auguring well for a united Europe.
Janusz, reading your book, it sounds like a game in which the ultimate victory is to capture France, subdue France on the part of Germany. But the simple question I think Americans don't really get yet is, what kind of a problem do we have? Is this a cultural, political, social problem of basically civilization breaking down, racism, fascism, this kind of tendency, or is it economics? Our friend Mark Blythe, who wrote about austerity years ago, has been telling me for years, this is not even an economic problem, it's a banking problem. It's a regulation problem. It's a design of a financial system problem. What do you think?
The two are inextricably linked. Who controls money controls politics. Who controls politics controls money. Capitalism did manage to succeed in creating some distance between the economic and the political sphere, but there is a dialectical relationship, as we left-wingers have been saying now for two centuries at least, between the two spheres, and it's impossible to separate them. It's both. It's both. Now, Mark Blythe is completely correct. I've been saying this myself, that the trigger for the economic, political, and social crisis of Europe, just like in the United States, was the excesses of financialization of the banking system. Yes, so it is true that the realm in which the crisis manifested itself was banking, but the fuel that was accumulating in the banking sector before it ignited, burning the house down, was due to the particular relations of power, of politics, of money-making that have characterized the world we live in. But you asked a more general question. What on earth is going on between France and Germany? Is Germany still trying to occupy France like it has done in the past? No, it's not. Or to put it differently, it is just as much as an attempt by German elites to capture Paris as it is by Parisian elites to capture Frankfurt and Berlin. Mm. Let's look at it from an American perspective. Think 1944, Bretton Woods. Think 1945, when the American GIs occupied Berlin and the United States was the only creditor nation of a distraught and destroyed Europe. It was around 1946, a year later, that Secretary Burns gave the speech of hope in Stuttgart, by which effectively he announced a new American policy, which was to end the process of deindustrializing Germany, formerly Nazi Germany, and to say to the French, look, we had an agreement that we will turn Germany into a pastoral land, but we are moving away from this agreement. We have a new situation in Europe. The United States needs to build Pax Americana. It needs to build the Bretton Woods system, the international global financial capital system, on a united Europe. And you and the Germans must find an accommodation. And it will be as follows. Germany will be reindustrialized. It will be the factory of Europe. And you, the French, will run the banks as well as the administration. It was this kind of Faustian bargain that the United States New Dealers in power at the time in Washington, D.C., imposed upon Europe. And this system worked brilliantly while the United States was a surplus country, while the United States was exporting more than it was importing and it was accumulating a surplus, right, which it had the capacity to use in order to stabilize primarily Europe, but also Japan. And this ended in 1971 with the Nixon shock, remember, John Connolly and Paul Volcker,
right,
and that crew, who were extremely pragmatic. They said, okay, well, we no longer have a surplus to recycle. That design is going to be blown up. And the result is a period, many decades since 1971, during which Europe effectively suffered a Eurexit. Europe, against its wishes, was jettisoned from the dollar zone by the Nixon administration, and it has never recovered its poise ever since.
Parenthetically, I've never understood that going off the gold standard move. You know, it is seen sometimes now as Richard Nixon's only way of financing the war in Vietnam. Wise people like Volcker were with him. Shady people like John Connolly were with him. Is there a long-term understanding of just why he did it?
He had no choice. He had no choice because the New Dealers created the Bretton Woods system in 1944. If you want, it was in the image of the New Deal. The New Deal, let me remind you, was an attempt to stabilize American capitalism, to bring about recovery of American capitals by doing something very simple. Taking idle savings, money that was sitting there idly, too scared to be invested because of their depression, and to actually put it to good use and restart the engine of the economy so that new incomes are produced, so that those incomes can be used in order to pay back debt and losses, and therefore stabilize the American. So the idea behind Bretton Woods is that the Americans, quite audaciously, would export this model to the rest of the world and manage it themselves. But the only way you can do this, the only way you can run a new deal at the global level, is if you are in a surplus position. So think of the Marshall Plan. What was the Marshall Plan? It was not some act of philanthropy. America, for 3-4 years, took 2% of its gross domestic product, aggregate income, and gave it to the Europeans. Gave it, didn't loan it, gave it to the Europeans. Imagine saying this to Donald Trump today. That's an aside. As I said, it was not philanthropy. The only way that the American factories could continue to produce at full blast in 1948, 49, 50, 51, 52, was by giving dollars to the Europeans to buy the stuff that these factories could produce, which was too much for the American consumers to purchase. Now, in order to do this, however, you need to have a surplus to recycle to Europe and to Japan. And while the United States was a surplus country, that system was not challenged either by the Republicans or by any other major force in the United States. But by 1965, 1966, the United States, primarily because of the Vietnam War, also because of the Great Society program of LBJ and so on and so forth, and the fact that the Japanese and German factories had become very competitive with American help, America lost its surpluses. So it could no longer continue doing this. And therefore, the system, international system of fixed exchange rates, where all the currencies, the British pound, the Deutschmark, the French franc, were tied to the dollar at a fixed exchange rate, that system could no longer be supported once America lost its surpluses. So it had to be blown up, and that's what they did. And remember, the people who did it were primarily Democrats. John Connally, the former governor of Texas, began life as a Democrat. Paul Volcker remains a Democrat. So there was a kind of bipartisan decision to blow it up.
This is a view of the global finance juggernaut from a man who fell under it. Yanis Varoufakis had a brief, brilliant stardom as finance minister of Greece's left-wing government in the first half of last year. Coming up, the ancient Greek fable of the industrious ant and the song and dance grasshopper, and how it came back to bite Greece in its debt crisis last year. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Yanis Varoufakis is speaking to us from the Greek island of Aegina. He's the global economist who got beaten but not broken or silenced by Europe's central bankers in Greece's unfinished debt crisis last summer. Yanis, if you would, come back to Europe, the big picture, the big ideal of democracy, of European unity, and the idea of shared prosperity. You've had some losses, including Brexit, and now Spanish politics, but why do I sense that you're winning the battle of ideas, the big ones, that Europe is too good an idea to go down, that the long-run trend is still running toward union in public opinion, that the euro itself, the money, the coin, is a problem, and that the United States has a way to show a different federal system that could work. What is standing in the way of a victory here?
I wouldn't be hasty enough to proclaim victory. This is going to be a long war, and we're going to suffer losses. We are suffering many losses. I don't consider Brexit to be so much of a loss in itself. It depends how Brexit is going to percolate in the next few years. The battles that we're facing are going to be very fierce because the nativist retreat to the nation state is quite appealing both to the right and to the left. I had to wage very serious discussions and arguments with fellow left-wingers of mine in Britain who were considering me a turncoat for continuing to believe in the European idea and to push for it. But you're right. In the end, internationalism wins hearts and minds if those of us who support it are steadfast in our support of it, and we have good arguments, and we manage to lower ourselves from the lofty heights of academic discourse and speak to the people in a language that they understand. Because this is what the Brexiters, this is what the nationalists do. They say to them, oh, you want our country back. Vote to disintegrate the European Union. So we need a narrative that appeals to the heart and the mind, that is simple, that is, it goes for the jugular, and it succeeds in making internationalism stick. In reality, there is no alternative to internationalism. Take climate change. It is impossible to have a Greek strategy against climate change, or a British one, or a French one, or a German one. Even a European one is not good enough. We need an international one. But internationalism in the European Union is the only way of beginning even to have a sensible discussion about climate change. Fighting against the TTIP agreement, which is a very insidious threat to democracy everywhere, including the United States. Doing something about the Syrian refugees, about migration. These are all questions that have to be settled at an international level. You know, despite my grave criticisms of the European Union, the fact that we have a continent that was uniting for many decades, then, you know, you can take a car or you can walk across the continent and you wouldn't notice where the borders are. Now they're creeping up again, unfortunately. But this is a great asset that needs to be preserved. Regarding the last point you made, I think this is quite a valid one. Whenever I want to demonstrate to bankers, to administrators, to politicians, to members of the public, the absurdity of Europe. You know, the one thing I do is I say, okay, imagine that in 2008, the United States was structured politically, financially, in terms of its banking, in terms of its administration, like the Eurozone. And I try to tell them what would happen in the state of Nevada if the banks of Nevada had to be saved by the state of Nevada and the unemployment benefits of their laid off construction workers of Nevada had to be paid by money that the state government of Nevada raised in Wall Street. Of course, the state of Nevada and the banks of Nevada and the people of Nevada would have been completely annihilated. Mm. And then there would be a domino effect going to Missouri, to Louisiana, eventually reaching the state of New York and California. And the reason why...
Only Massachusetts would be left.
Probably. And Texas. I try throughout the European Union to use the United States as an example of the kind of organization we need, the kind of thinking that we need in order to do that which the Americans did in the 19th century and beyond, to use crisis in order to consolidate as opposed to use crisis in order to blow the whole thing up. Now, that doesn't mean that the United States is a model of governance, but Europe has become so irrational and so authoritarian that we have made you guys look good.
I want to ask you a question about these national differences, and it's a slightly rude one. You know, you say all of these crises begin in Greece, that the Nazi crisis began in Greece, the Euro crisis began in Greece.
The Cold War began in Greece. Don't forget the Cold War.
Going way, way, way back, I think it began with Aesop and this fable of the ant and the grasshopper. And I think most people still believe it about Greeks and Germans. The Germans produce Einstein, the Greeks produce Zorba. And in the United States even, we think we work harder in Massachusetts than they work in Mississippi. And we talk faster, we have more colleges, et cetera, et cetera. Who's to say that these aren't real differences? And what do you do about them if they are?
Oh, they're very real. There's no doubt that they are very real differences. You know, there is precisely zero cars that Greece exports to Germany because you don't make any. So this is a real fact. The question is why? Is it something in the national character? Is it in the DNA? Is it in the kind of food we eat? Or is it a historical process which ensures that capital develops unevenly and there are pockets of excess capacity, cartels, oligopoly capital, which then make it almost impossible for even development throughout. And then on top of that, cartelization and heterogeneity, you build trade agreements, you build common currencies and monetary systems which recycle the super profits of the oligopolistic advanced areas to the deficit backward areas where you create huge bubbles and then those burst and in the end, the burden of adjustment falls on the weakest of shoulders, and then that turns proud nations against one another. I think it's the latter. This is, of course, a much broader discussion that black people have had to endure for centuries. Why is it that there has never been a successful black imperialist power? Well, We now know, we have known for a while from anthropological work why that is. It's got to do with geography, with the fact that the agricultural revolution and surplus production and accumulation necessitated the Eurasian peninsula capable of sustaining the same crops from Portugal all the way to the Pacific. Whereas in Africa, where you've got lots of climate zones going north and south, it would be impossible to have an empire that invades Europe. Any attempt to ascribe power and particular industrial patterns to DNA, to ethnicity, to culture, is simply bad history.
Right. In your books and talks, Yanis, you give example after example of a phony game around the euro. It's all about French and German loans to Greece that actually go 90 cents on the dollar back to French and German banks. In the Irish case too, there were the Germans trying to get the Irish people to pay off bad loans of now defunct private banks. There's something deeply wrong here. The German foreign minister says to you, man to man, that he, in your position, would not sign off on the loans that he was forcing on you. There's something deranged here. And people say to you, professionals, even politicians, Yanis, of course you're right, but we can't say it. When does this bubble burst for good?
Oh, well, we are rich enough in Europe to carry on inflating it artificially while depleting the resources of our societies and the reputation of Europe for a very long time. The richer you are, the longer you can stay solvent while you're doing the wrong thing and you're depleting your wealth. The tragedy of Europe at the moment is that we have all the ills that you have experienced on the other side of the pond, with bankers creating Ponzi growth, with the pyramids that Wall Street was constructing, creating a semblance of, you remember Ben Bernanke's Great Moderation, which was anything but a great moderation. We have all those processes of creating phony money, which in the end explodes or implodes, with the burden of adjustment and the cost falling on the weakest of shoulders, as it happened in the United States after 2008. But on top of that, we lack the political mechanism for salvaging a semblance of consolidation after the crisis. So in the United States, as I was saying before, using the example of Nevada, when the paper pyramids that the bankers had created collapsed, Hank Paulson, Tim Geithner, several of these fine gentlemen who had caused the crisis in the first place with their shenanigans in previous years and decades, well, they got together around the table and asked the pertinent question, how do we stop this crisis from consuming us? And then they did what it took. They bent rules. They took, you know, a trillion and gave it to the bankers. Then Larry Summers and Tim Geithner created that fantastic, fantastic, ironically, if you remember the Summers-Geithner plan for reflating the derivatives market. But in the end, they stabilized the whole thing without destroying the weakest states of the Union. In Europe, which was lacking this table where people could sit around and ask the right question. Well, actually, we had the table, but you know, they asked precisely the wrong question. Instead of asking, so what do we do in order to stop this crisis from destroying us, destroying the powerful, that is, they asked the following question. So how do we now continue to pretend that our rules, according to which there is no federal government and there is no mutualization of pain, how can we pretend that we can carry on doing this? You don't get the same answer to the same question as you get to the first. In the second case, what you end up with is what you said. You take the Irish people to the cleaners. You force them at gunpoint. This is what happened in 2009. At gunpoint, the government of Ireland was forced to take on the public books, on the public purse, all the potential losses of private bondholders of a failed Irish bank on behalf of bondholders who happened to be German. And at the same time, you had the German government pointing moralizing fingers at the Irish, accusing them of being grasshoppers, when German growth for years was based on effectively vendor financing. So just like some people who don't have the money to buy a car go to a car dealer and say, I want this car and I want the money to buy it, and you get both, so you get a subprime mortgage of sorts in order to buy a car. Ireland, Greece, Spain, Italy were being given those kinds of loans to buy German goodies. And while this Ponzi scheme was continuing, everything was fine. But when the whole thing collapsed, the German government demanded of our governments that they carry on borrowing money from the German taxpayer and the Slovak taxpayer to pretend that these loans are still good. That can't end well.
Yeah, Iceland, not to be confused with Ireland, basically told the European bankers to go to hell. We're out of here. Ireland knuckled under. And I never understood why, but then a member of the Irish Parliament told me, they said to us, 50% of your national economy is tied into the European banking system and will croak you if you leave.
It's actually harsher than that. Iceland is also connected to the European Union financially. The difference between Iceland on the one hand and Ireland on the other, or Greece for that matter, is that Iceland has its own Fed. Iceland has its own central bank.
Yes, interesting.
And it can print its own money. And it can say to outsiders, you want some money? Take some of ours. Even if we divide it by 70%, suddenly you haircut your unsustainable foreign debt. And in our case, in the case of the Eurozone countries like Ireland, like Greece, let me tell you exactly what happened in 2009. When the German bondholders, people who had actually lend money to private Irish banks, were on the verge of losing that money because that particular Irish bank was going to go belly up, the president of the European Fed, of the European Central Bank, called the Irish Prime Minister and said to him something really very clear. Either you make your taxpayers repay all this money to the German bondholders, or I close down your banks tomorrow. You know, Janet Yellen can close down all of America's banks tomorrow if she wants. I'm not saying she will. Don't worry. Don't panic. But she can if she wants. All she has to do is make a statement that there will be no liquidity provisions to any American bank again. That's it. Finished. Kaput. Your banks would not open tomorrow. The ATMs cease functioning. So Janet Yellen has the capacity to threaten the federal government with a cessation of the financial system. Of course, she would never do that. And if she did, I think that the president of the United States should order the FBI to walk into the Fed and have her arrested. But in Europe, that is not the case. In Europe, the president of the ECB can call the prime minister of Ireland and say, either you do X, Y, Z, whatever that X, Y, Z is, sell your children, whatever, or I close down your banks. This is precisely what happened to me. On the third day I was in the Ministry of Finance, I assumed the Ministry of Finance on the 27th of January 2015. 3 days later, the president of the Eurogroup came to visit me, and this was not the beginning of a wonderful friendship, because within 5 minutes of us being alone, after all the pompous stuff had been completed, he said to me, if you insist on renegotiating your loan agreement with your creditors, your banks will be closed by the end of the month. And that was the 30th of January.
Mm. But what if you or the Irish had said, go ahead, close them. We can subsist for the days or weeks it takes to recover, and we're not going to pay. Exactly your move. No on further loans.
Well, this is precisely what the Irish should have said to Trichet, in particular in 2009, because it was an empty threat. It was a non-credible threat. Had he gone through with his threat to shut down the Irish banks, the whole of the Eurozone would have collapsed then. It was so precariously balanced. In my case, in our case, let me just answer in two ways. Firstly, this is precisely what I said. I said, do your worst, close them. And indeed, they did. A few months later, as you know, on the 29th of June, they closed down our banks. Your strategy, or what you implied as the right strategy, was the one that I had an agreement with the Greek Prime Minister we would pursue. We would say to them, close them down. We had planned an alternative payment system in order to make ends meet, to effect some transactions so that the economy would not grind to a halt immediately. And we were convinced that if they saw that we were calling their bluff, they would have come back. Unfortunately, my prime minister caved in on the day of the referendum when the Greek people supported that strategy with a 62% magnificent vote.
We remember that night well, and we still We still don't understand it. He called the referendum, sort of like David Cameron on Brexit. He said, vote no, and they did, and then he caved.
Well, it's not difficult to imagine what his motives were. They were not the same as mine. You don't ask me to say more. You can understand that. But let me also inform our audience that as we speak, over the last few days, there's been a furor in Greece because I have come out quite openly and have explained the strategy of governmental disobedience, as I call it, of saying no to them, close down our banks, and we will carry on fighting. And also having a plan by which to retaliate to the European Central Bank, and if they throw us out of the euro, of how to survive, because I believe that it is incumbent upon a democratically elected government of a sovereign nation to have such a plan. As we speak, there is a parliamentary process in Greek Parliament, in Athens, to have me indicted by the end of the month for high treason.
Wow. Is this a joke or serious?
No, it's not a joke. It's not a joke. It is a joke, but it is also a due process within the Greek Parliament, which is going to be completed one way or the other by the end of the month. But it just goes to show that the enemy is not always without. The enemy is also within, especially after our government caved in. It caved in and allowed the local representatives of the troika of lenders, that is, oligarchs, whose only means of survival is the Ponzi loans that they get from the Troika, directly or indirectly. They were the fifth column, if you want, within.
From Yanis Varoufakis, this is a short course in the logic of modern money, also known as neoliberalism. He calls it the religion of global finance. Coming up, a caution to American voters in 2016 about both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. We are learning something this hour about the collision of banking doctrine with democracy, when a proud people cannot see a way to cover their losses. Yanis Varoufakis was the Greek finance minister last year who thought it would be better to default on unpayable debts than to paper them over with another round of loans. A related puzzle on this side of the picture, Yanis, what is Europe missing that we seem to understand in our bones now about the beauty of bankruptcy? Donald Trump is famous now for shedding these casinos when they're not working for him. And as he says, he uses the laws of the United States to float up in another form. We don't send people eternally to the poorhouse anymore. Much rather let them go belly up and start again. Maybe retrained or refinanced or whatever. Why doesn't Europe see this about Greece? Why doesn't Greece see it about itself? Go bankrupt. Start again.
Well, there are two different standards, double standards. On the one hand, when the German and the French banks went bankrupt, the French and German parliaments had no hesitation whatsoever to refinance them to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars or euros. Hundreds of billions. And no questions asked. They didn't let them go bankrupt because they have a certain aversion to bankruptcy, especially when those who would go bankrupt are their mates and those that financed them for so many years. But when it came to the Greek state, we had a remarkable moment in history. That was around 2010 when the Greek Prime Minister of the time, George Papandreou, went to Berlin and went to Paris and said to them, sorry folks, but we're bankrupt. And he received what I refer to as the nine cubed, the no cubed, no to the power of three, no to a bailout, no to low interest rate relief, and no, you are not allowed to declare bankruptcy. Imagine if the CEO of Lehman Brothers walked into the office of Hank Paulson in 2008, in September, October, whenever it was, and said, Lehman's is dead. Please give me a bailout. Imagine if Hank Paulson responded by saying, no bailout, and you're not allowed to go bankrupt. It would not compute. It would make no sense. What are you going on about? How can you ask me not to go bankrupt when I'm bankrupt, and you're not bailing me out either? So this is what we had. After a while, of course, this 999 became a double nine. The bailout loans did come, but they came with strings that ensured that the incomes from which the old and the new loan would shrink so much that they would never be able to repay the old and the new loans.
Mm. This brings us back to the long game and what you call the religion of neoliberalism, which, as you're suggesting, I mean, it starts with imposing unsustainable loans on people or countries and give the creditors, the bankers, huge power over the society. And it's written into the agreement that they will start cutting what we think of as essential public pensions or services. And we will make an example of the poor and the weak. Greece, maybe Portugal, maybe Ireland. And we will scare the wits out of Italy first and then France eventually. Where is it going from here?
Let me say that I don't believe that they had this conspiracy in their mind to begin with. To begin with, it was a cock-up, which turned into a conspiracy. There was no plan for this at all. Every day they were saying, okay, how do we impose upon the weak another chunk of our losses so that we do not have to reveal our bankruptcy? And every time they did that, they fanned the flames of recession, reducing incomes further amongst those on whom they relied to buy the goodies that capitalists were producing. So you had a collapse of capitalism as a result of a cock-up that turned into a conspiracy. The problem with neoliberalism is that it has been so dominant for so long that even those who oppose it, deep down, if you hypnotize them, psychoanalyze them, they sort of believe that in the end, you know, we may kick and scream, we may fight them on the beaches, but in the end we will be defeated because there is no alternative. Until and unless we put in the mind of people that there are very straightforward alternatives and that we could actually even use existing institutions before we have socialism, anarchism, the good society, any kind of revolution. Tomorrow morning, by using existing tools that we have at our disposal, like the European Central Bank, the European Stability Mechanism, the European Investment Bank, and so on, simply by radically changing what these institutions do and make changes that are actually legal, at least within the letter, if not the spirit of the law, of the neoliberal law, that we can just turn the whole thing around. If we put this idea into the mind of the majority of people, we have a political revolution, to quote Bernie Sanders.
Come back to the democratic question, the really crucial one, that the people in the end are going to be sovereign. You quote the German finance minister, Mr. Schäuble, Herr Schäuble, saying that elections cannot be allowed to change the economic policy of a country. I mean, did he really say that? And who's going to say, mein Herr, that's exactly what elections are for?
I'll tell you verbatim what happened and what was said. After my presentation, in which I thought I was stating the obvious and that I was, if anything, exceedingly moderate. It was my first presentation in the Eurogroup. The Eurogroup is the gathering of finance ministers and apparatchiks around the Eurozone, the common currency area. I tried to make a very simple point that there are two principles here that are clashing. One is the principle of continuity. There is a program, an economic program for Greece that you all guys like and want to continue imposing on my country. But there is also the principle of democracy. I was elected to renegotiate this and to challenge this. So what happens in a democracy when you have two principles that clash against one another? We sit down and we find a compromise. This is what liberal democracy is about. And I thought that everybody would agree with this, and then it would simply be a matter of disagreeing on what compromise to reach. Silly me. Schäuble, and this is why actually I like Schäuble, because he's so straightforward. He put his hand out and speaks the following words verbatim. Elections cannot be allowed to change the economic policies for Greece. Full stop.
Oof. And this is auf Deutsch, in English, or Greek, or what?
No, in English. Everybody speaks English in the Eurogroup, except the French Minister of Finance, Michel Sapin, who speaks French. Typical French, right? it was actually, Wolfgang Schäuble speaks very good English. So it was all said verbatim, as I told you, okay? Not with that accent, but the words are the same. And he explained it a bit further, saying that the Eurozone is not a federation. every decision has to be unanimous. So when we reach a decision, that's it. It cannot be changed. So if one government changes because of a democratic mandate, you cannot have the new government renegotiate an agreement of the previous government. This was his meaning. Now, of course, that means this is a complete violation of every democratic sovereignty principle, where, you know, today's Congress cannot commit the next Congress on something, right? This is the whole point about the sovereignty of Congress. The Congress is indivisible and perpetual, but its decisions are not perpetual. Its decisions can change according to the will of the people.
Right.
So when it was my turn to speak, I said, Dr. Schäuble, you just made the greatest gift to the Chinese Communist Party, because they believe exactly the same thing. They believe that elections should not change economic policy. You can understand now why I wasn't particularly liked in that group.
I keep wondering if you're ever going to be forgiven for saying no to bankers that big. But my real observation would be that people push back at that sort of arrogance. And you said you were surprised that they voted so overwhelmingly no on the question, the popular referendum. You expected it to lose, and it won. It was 62%. You felt a real powerful democratic victory in that. You said the one deficit the voters could not bear was the deficit of dignity.
Indeed.
Where are we going to hear Indeed. And feel that again?
Look, you see, dignity in the end is the last resort of a battered people. The last asset that one will die in order to preserve. When dignity is threatened, at some point, there comes a moment when calculation really doesn't matter in the end. And you simply do that which is right. It's the reason why people have rebelled against very powerful empires. It's the reason why heroic acts have taken place, which change the world. It happens very infrequently. Usually people succumb to calculation, cost and benefit. But there comes a moment when you push people so far that in the end they will say, to hell with it, I'm going to do what is right and not that which is expedient according to my calculation of net benefits and net costs. And this is what happened on the 5th of July 2015. I was walking through the crowds and I could feel the indignation. And indignation, of course, is a word which is etymologically intimately linked with dignity. They felt that they had nothing left to lose. That, you know, the Janis Joplin line, freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose, except dignity. And it was all over Athens, all over Greece. And indeed, this is quite remarkable. This is the first occasion, and probably the last, where an election, a referendum, is won in every constituency in the country, every single one of them. That has never been the case. And this is why on that night, I was levitating, almost. I was transported to another kind of dimension by this defiance of the crowds. I hadn't expected it, I must tell you. Maybe I've been around economists for too long. With the banks closed, with Europe issuing all those statements that we are going to be confined to the dustbin of Europe if the Greek people dare to vote no along with us, I thought, well, they will be worn down. Maybe we will score 46, 47%, which still would be magnificent, given that in the election we had 40%. But the 62% went beyond the wildest imagination that I could ever conjure up.
Yanis Varoufakis, come back, finally, if you will, to Brexit and what that has done to the storyline here. The British voters voted leave more narrowly, but they were saying bye-bye to a system that you say is off the rails. And you say they made a mistake. They should have voted to stay, work it out, fight it out. Explain that paradox here.
Well, a couple of points. Firstly, the real reason behind the venom with which the Brexiters, those who voted for Brexit, voted against the European Union, has very little to do with the European Union. Firstly, you must realize that this is not a British experience. It's an English experience. In Scotland, they voted overwhelmingly to stay in the European Union. It's not because they don't share my criticism of Brussels or that they love Brussels. It's just that they share the view that I've been putting forward and which you have explained very nicely, that, okay, Europe is seriously dysfunctional, but we are like a dysfunctional family that needs therapy, not destruction. This is an English phenomenon, excluding London. What has happened is this. For 30 years now, neoliberal economic policies have been marginalizing and treating with contempt the English working class, starting with Margaret Thatcher in the late 70s, early 1980s. The English working class feels that they have been disenfranchised. They feel that they've been left behind by elites that fly to Paris every weekend, that have holiday homes in the rest of the continent, that are globalized, who love to have migrants coming into Britain in order to push wages that they, if they're lucky, receive when they work at the supermarket, the checkout counter, push them down. And they were asking a simple question: how can we piss off those elites in London who are conspiring to turn us into foreigners in our own country? Mm. And let me give you another example. If you look at the cities where there is a very large proportion of migrants, they tended to vote, the English working class, tended to vote to stay in the European Union.
Yes, fascinating. I mean, Manchester and Glasgow, yeah, as well as London.
That's right. The paradox is the ones who fear the migrants the most are the ones who didn't have to live with them. And the only explanation I can come up with was that, as always, when you have a deflationary crisis like we had in Europe in the 1930s, xenophobia rears its ugly head. But the reason for the xenophobia is not some kind of instinctive hatred of the foreign, for the foreigner or the other, but an instinctive reaction to recession and to depression. Depression is what caused people in Middlesbrough, in Doncaster, in Leeds, in Yorkshire to vote for Brexit. And that depression has to do with neoliberal policies. The fact that the European Union is also so grossly anti-democratic caused some of my comrades on the left in Britain also to vote against the European Union. So there was a perfect storm. The victims of austerity and those who disdain the authoritarianism and deep contempt for democratic process in Brussels coalesced to vote for Brexit.
Interesting. Yanis, the last final question. From a European perspective, have a look at the United States in 2016. Neoliberalism figures in our race too, and the reaction against it even after the Bernie Sanders campaign. Score it. How do we look for it? How's to vote?
Huh. My goodness. I bet you don't have an answer to that question.
That's why I want you to help.
What I think matters the most at the moment is the conversion of the Bernie Sanders political revolution into a lasting political party of sorts, a political movement that does not die out once the convention is over, once the presidential election is over. What Bernie Sanders managed to do is magnificent, should have a dynamic future, and should infect in the nicest possible way American politics for many years to come. In the short run, there is no doubt that even though I consider Hillary Clinton to be a particularly dangerous person and an unwholesome politician, nevertheless, when you face Donald Trump on the opposite side, you have to make sure that somehow we block his passage to the White House.
Any other alternatives? Any other blockade mechanisms?
Oh, what is absolutely essential is, assuming that Hillary will win, that we make her life complete and utter misery every time she drifts and slides towards her usual geopolitical menace on the one hand, or favoritism of Wall Street and the powers that be on the other hand.
You're tempting me to write in Varoufakis.
No comment.
If elected, you will serve, right?
Absolutely. I never turn down a mandate.
Yanis Varoufakis, you do the impossible. You make economics incredibly personal, interesting, engaging, almost comprehensible, occasionally funny, and maybe it'll save us. Keep talking, please, and keep talking with us.
As my daughter says, it is impossible to stop me from talking to the detriment of people who love me and have to live with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great speaking with you.
We've been listening to Yanis Varoufakis from the Greek island of Aegina. He was Greece's finance minister in the debt crunch of 2015. He got his new book title from a famous ultimatum in Athens' war with Sparta in ancient times. The line was, "And the weak suffer what they must." In the original, it was a statement of policy. Yanis Varoufakis adds a question mark. There's a lot more good talk on our website, including our Brexit Radio Hour with Mark Blythe and Simon Sharma, among others. Be sure to check it out at radioopensource.org. Our show is produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Zach Goldhammer. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.